160 people are still missing after the flooding in Central Texas. What are conditions like for search teams? We'll ask the Army veteran who led military relief efforts after Hurricane Katrina. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Another massive drone attack hits Kyiv, causing fires across the city as Russia tries to overwhelm Ukraine's defenses. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez. Also, CDC figures show the last time the U.S. had this many measles cases was more than 30 years ago. And with so many angsty superheroes, is it actually edgy to not be cynical? We'll talk with one of the heads of DC Studios, James Gunn, about his new movie, Superman. It's Thursday, July 10th. On this day in 1962, NASA launched Telstar 1, the first satellite to beam TV images from Europe to North America. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. A new analysis from NPR and data scientists find at least 17 buildings and cabins at campsites in Central Texas were at greater risk than the government previously reported. The area was swamped with floodwaters, blamed for at least 120 deaths, with more than 160 others still missing. NPR's Laura Sullivan has more.
An analysis by climate modeling company First Street found FEMA failed to properly account for the threat from rainfall when developing its maps. It wasn't just a problem at the camp. FEMA's maps undercount the number of homes in danger throughout the country. Data scientists say FEMA relies on tidal surge and river data, and the agency lacks funding and a mandate to update its process. NPR found special interest groups like home builders associations often lobby to prevent the agency from getting that funding. At Camp Mystic, NPR also found at least 8 buildings, including cabins for younger campers, located inside the floodway, a dangerous area expected to see high-velocity water. Laura Sullivan, NPR News.
Russia bombarded Ukraine again last night in an hours-long assault that left at least 2 people dead. This as President Trump made an abrupt turnaround on weapons to Ukraine, saying the U.S. will send additional weapons after a pause by the Pentagon. But it's unclear what will be sent and what might still be on hold. And NPR's Tom Bowman has more.
All we know is that Trump has overruled Pentagon leaders who announced that halt. And he said, quote, "We're going to send more weapons. We have to. They have to be able to defend themselves." He said this as Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth was sitting next to him. Now, he wasn't specific, and the Pentagon would only say in a statement it was sending additional defensive weapons, and that was all. Now, we expect they'll send more Patriot missiles. There are some 30 being held in Poland, according to a U.S. official who was not authorized to speak. And these missiles, of course, have been key in destroying incoming Russian missiles.
And NPR's Tom Bowman reporting. President Trump announced a 50% tariff on imports from Brazil, but as NPR's Daniel Kurtzleben reports, the new threat is different from the other ones he made this week.
Trump announced the tariff rate by posting a letter to Brazilian President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva on social media Wednesday, his 22nd letter this week. All of the other letters were similar, telling countries that the new tariffs were being imposed to rectify their trade imbalances with the U.S., but the letter to Brazil was about politics. Trump angrily referenced what he calls a witch hunt against former far-right president Jair Bolsonaro, who is facing trial for an alleged attempted coup against Lula. Trump has long praised the far-right Bolsonaro, who lost in a 2022 re-election bid against Lula. Shortly thereafter, Bolsonaro's supporters stormed the capital, Brasilia. Danielle Kurtzleben, NPR News.
This is NPR News. A class action lawsuit over President Trump's birthright citizenship restrictions will be heard in federal court in New Hampshire today. The suit, filed by the ACLU, seeks to block Trump's January order denying citizenship to babies born to undocumented or temporary residents. They argue the Constitution's 14th Amendment guarantees citizenship to those born in the U.S. Several federal judges issued injunctions against the order, but the Supreme Court recently limited those rulings. This as legal battles continue across several states. A new study identified more than 16,000 chemicals in plastic, many of which are considered chemicals of concern because of the risks to human health. NPR's Will Stone has more.
Even though plastic is pervasive in our lives, there are still major gaps in our understanding of their chemical composition. The team of scientists based in Norway and Switzerland did a comprehensive review and identified more than 4,200 chemicals of concern. Bisphenols, phthalates, and PFAS, or forever chemicals, are just a few examples. Those can show up everywhere from toys to food packaging to tires. The results were published in the journal Nature. The authors report the sheer number of chemicals is far beyond what governments and manufacturers can study to ensure their safety. In fact, nearly 11,000 of the 16,000 chemicals identified lack official hazard classifications. The authors say many of these harmful chemicals can be replaced with safer alternatives. Will Stone, NPR News.
U.S. futures contracts are trading lower at this hour. I'm Janine Herbst, and you're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Capital One with the Capital One Saver Card. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at MacFound.org.
Oftentimes what people serve, whether it be physical or mental challenges, they keep that to themselves because it's not about them. It's always about that service.
This is Beyond Active Duty, Caring for Those Who Served, a series exploring the challenges Minnesota's veterans face, as well as the opportunities and services available to them.
I'm Dave Kleiss, Mayor of St. Cloud, and served in the United States Air Force and Air Force Reserve. And then I had a younger brother, Tom, who was on active duty in the Marines and ended up having some challenges that really stayed with him, I think, most of his life, some physical and some emotional issues. And unfortunately, in 2020, he took his life. It came as a shock to us. It's a tough thing as a brother and the rest of our family not knowing what somebody's going through. And that's why, in my opinion, it's always extremely important to reach out and to have veterans reach out and always to focus on, especially those who seem to always be serving others, making sure that we also serve them and have that same kindness returned.
Beyond Active Duty, Caring for Those Who Served is produced by AMPERS with support from the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs, providing our veterans with help. Veterans can find that help online at MinnesotaVeteran.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C. Good morning. Last night, hundreds of mourners gathered in a football stadium at Tyvee High School in Kerrville, Texas.
They came together to remember those who died in last week's flash floods that have killed at least 120 people. It was also a vigil for the many more who are still missing.
The Texas Newsroom's Lucia Vasquez joins us now from Kerrville to tell us more about all this. Good morning, Lucia.
Good morning.
So just paint a picture for me, if you would. Tell us about the gathering at the high school last night.
Yeah, well, organizers held a large cross in front of the bleachers, which were filled with grieving neighbors. They prayed together, they sang, remembering those that they had lost. The vigil also included a tribute to Camp Mystic. It's a Christian girls' summer camp here in the area that became the heart of one of the deadliest natural disasters in Texas history. Many in attendance were also wearing green ribbons. That's the official color of the camp. Randy Rose was also at the vigil. He told me that this is a pretty tight-knit community and that any loss is really felt by everyone here.
It was a time of healing. It was a time of trying to get back to some normalcy and step away from the tragedy for a minute. It was a moment to just pause, catch our breath, and remember that there's still light and goodness.
You know, many stayed after the vigil ended. Kids were running around the football field, balls were being tossed back and forth, and there were a lot of hugs. And so people said that they felt lighter after being there.
Oh, that's good to hear. And you've also been talking with people who were in the path of the river, who of course now are trying to put their lives back together. So just tell us a little bit about what they told you.
Yeah, there's just been an overwhelming sense of disbelief and exhaustion. I spoke with another man. His name is John Cox. He's a 77-year-old man who's been here for a few years. He has a house just down the road, and he told me that he's never seen anything quite like this, that his place was almost completely submerged by the river when it crested.
Flood got in the house. You know, you can see the mattresses out there, ruined all of the furniture in the house.
He's been cleaning for days now, filling a nearby dumpster, but despite losing most of his home, he actually says he's grateful for the help he's received from the community and from volunteers who've come into town after the floods. And the response has been striking. I've seen what looks to be an army of volunteers and public safety agencies setting up shop throughout the region to help search for victims and jumpstart recovery efforts.
I think that people are starting to, you know, look at their state and local officials and ask them, you know, talk about the lack of preparedness and in some places people not getting warnings in time. Is this being addressed?
Yes, and you know, that's what locals have been telling the Texas newsroom, that they didn't get sufficient warnings or that they never got an alert at all. And there's been a lot of questions and people want to know what exactly happened. At yesterday's press conference here in Kerr County Sheriff Larry Letha, he said that officials would be investigating.
When or if necessary, if improvements need to be made, improvements will be made.
Notably, earlier this spring, state lawmakers voted down a bill that would have provided more money for communications and warning systems during natural disasters. But now Texas Governor Greg Abbott says fixing that is a priority. So yesterday, he called for a special session of the state legislature for later this month, and he wants lawmakers to pass a new bill that would provide funding to improve early warning systems and other preparedness infrastructure in flood-prone areas across Texas. The question for a lot of people here, though, is whether that will prevent a tragedy like this from happening again.
That is the Texas Newsroom's Lucille Vasquez. Lucille, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
With more than 160 people believed missing in Texas Hill Country, search teams continue to scour the area around the Guadalupe River. Texas officials say they haven't found any survivors since the river overflowed on July 4th. To help us understand the challenges facing these search teams, we've called on retired Lieutenant General Russell Honore. He led the effort to bring military relief to New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina, and he spent years working on disaster recovery operations. He joins us this morning from Baton Rouge, Louisiana. General, so what, based on what you're seeing and hearing out of Texas, how challenging would the conditions be right now for these teams?
Yeah, they're working on the riverbanks and in the river in enormous heat. And up until 2 days ago, they still had flooded threats of floor warming because water was still falling. It was still raining. So it's a big challenge. Because the debris that's moved by the rapids in the water get piled up, and that's where they're finding the remains that have been found in recent days. It's very difficult work, working in very heated condition, and the people that are saving the day are the volunteers. There are some 2,000 volunteers on top of the state officials that are out there.
You know, General, in Los Angeles, I've been through my share of earthquakes, and one of the things that I know is that the debris and the damage is right there in front of you. There's nothing in the way. How much does standing water complicate things?
Well, it does, because it piles the debris up, as you've seen on video and on newsreels, and that's where they are finding the remains, and there's some they can't see. Because they may be in the mud and they're still having to fight that water. At the banks are still wet. So to get the equipment in there and to get people in, you got to carefully remove each debris bank. It's not like bringing the excavator in and start moving debris. You've got to take it off a piece at a time in respect that that might be a person under the next piece of wood you're picking up. It's very difficult work to accomplish. At the same time, it has to be organized in a way to ensure that every spot get two checks. You do a visual check, and then you come back and you start removing the debris. And that's over about a 60-kilometer area that's got to be investigated, particularly those south of the camp where the majority of the people that are known to be come out of the southern camps near Kerrville.
Yeah, and as awful as this might be to even imagine, you know, when it's rushing water, it can take people, and in this case, if we're looking for bodies, away from where they would normally be or where they would normally live, sometimes even miles. Could that be one of the reasons why the number of people still missing is so high days after the flooding?
Yeah, there have been reports of people being found 12 miles from where they were, and even further. So the water has a tremendous impact on where you look and when you look. It's a very difficult task to accomplish. We're, again, blessed by the volunteers, working with all the first responders, and they're using every piece of technology available to include cadaver dogs, which makes them very exhausted in the heat and working around the water. So they've got a lot of boots on the ground now, and this is going to be long, arduous work to find all the remains, and the governor has committed to finding everyone, and that's going to take weeks, if not months. We're still finding remains after Katrina, a month or 2 months after the flood.
Wow. So, General, if teams do indeed find remains, what happens after that? What happens next?
Then they call in the emergency response people to come and document that. So they're using body bags, and then they go take them to a holding area where they then have to identify who the person is. And that goes into, in some cases, using DNA, taking DNA from the remains and posting that. And people that have relative missing that have been asked to provide their DNA because it may not be recognizable. And we did that for several months after Katrina to identify remains.
That's retired Lieutenant General Russell Honoré, who led military relief operations after Hurricane Katrina. General, thank you for sharing your thoughts on this with us.
Good day.
Hundreds of State Department employees are expected to get pink slips in the coming hours or days now that the Supreme Court has cleared the way for the downsizing of the federal government. Secretary of State Marco Rubio is making a 15% cut at his department, and that's after the Trump administration dismantled the lead U.S. aid agency. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports.
Former diplomats with the American Academy of Diplomacy described the reduction in forces at the State Department as an act of vandalism.
And there's been no explanation for why this has happened.
Thomas Shannon was in a top job at the department at the start of the first Trump administration. There were lots of career diplomats retiring at that time, he recalls, but this is different.
It's all about deciding, okay, we're going to remove a significant hunk of our civil service and foreign service employees and restructure the department in ways that reflect a diminished global agenda.
With less focus on human rights and democracy, among other things. Secretary of State Marco Rubio has pushed back on that argument, saying he just wants to cut a bloated bureaucracy. He told senators in May how much it takes just to get a memo on his desk.
There were 40 boxes on this piece of paper. That means 40 people had to check off, yes, okay, before it even got to me. That's ridiculous. And if any one of those little boxes didn't get checked, the memo didn't move up the chain. That can't continue. We can't move at that pace in this world.
Rubio's new organizational chart cuts 132 offices at headquarters, and his State Department recently changed the rules for a reduction in forces so that he can simply fire people in the offices being cut. Ambassador Shannon calls that a mistake.
We're going to end up cutting a lot of really talented individuals who are going to be like in musical chairs. They're going to suddenly find themselves without a chair, and so they're out.
That means losing experts with language and cultural skills. Shannon says that, plus the loss of USAID, may not be felt right away, but will put the U.S. in the back seat in its global competition with China. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, the State Department.
This is NPR News.
Good morning. It is 6:19. Coming up, we've got information on fishing, the Early Bird Fishing Guide, Jeff Sundin. I'm Heidi Holton. Hope you're having a good morning. We're seeing rain and thunder throughout our region, through much of our region, could actually use your help. Let us know what the weather's like where you are. You can text 218-326-1234. We're expecting for the day that we could see some severe early morning thunderstorms are expected today. Then additional storms are possible later this afternoon and into the evening. And a few strong to isolated severe storms are possible this evening. We're expecting temperatures from 80 to 86, increasing clouds overnight, temperatures in the low to mid 60s, a chance for showers and thunderstorms tonight, and showers likely with possible thunderstorms again tomorrow, highs 80 to 83, and by Saturday, mostly sunny with slight chance of rain, highs 75 to 77 degrees. Thanks so much for tuning in to People Powered KAXE. We welcome you, and we also ask for your help. KXE's future is on the line. Last month, the U.S. House voted to rescind federal funding for public media. This goes to the Senate next, and the rescission proposal expires on July 18th. That means time is of the essence for you to send your senators a message that public radio like KAXE is vital, especially in rural places. Go to protectmypublicmedia.org for connections. We bring you fact-checked news, student nature reports, connection to community, and great music. It's available to everyone, free of charge. Your support and your voice can make a difference. As always, call us if you have questions. We'd love to talk with you about it. You can call 218-326-1234. We receive support from Klocko Brewing Company in Grand Rapids, making traditional old world styles of beer as well as modern classics for 7 years. Their tap room is open Monday through Saturday, noon to 8, Sunday from noon to 6. More information, KlockoBrewing.com.
Gone fishing. Babble, 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 babble. There's a sign upon your door.
Pops, don't blab it around, will you?
Gone fishing.
Keep it shady. I got me a big one staked out.
You ain't working anymore.
I don't have to work. I got me a piece of Gary.
Cows need milking in the barn.
I have the twins on that detail. They each take a side.
But you just don't give a darn.
Give them 4 bits of cow and hand lotion.
You just never seem to learn.
Man, you taught me.
You ain't got no ambition.
You're convincing me.
Gone fishing. Got your hound dog by your side.
That's old Cindy Lou going with me.
Gone fishing. Fleas are biting at his hide.
Get away from me, boys. You're bothering me. Folks won't find us now because Mr. Satch and Mr. Cross, we gone fishing. Instead of just a wishing.
Bumpo, baby, bumpo, 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 there.
Oh, yeah.
Time to talk fishing with our early bird fishing guide, Jeff Sundin. He joins us now. Morning, Jeff.
Good morning.
I suppose with we've got thunder and rain here, this is the kind of day a fishing guide's got to make some decisions, huh?
It would appear that I'm going to make at least one decision, and that's going to be to bring my raincoat with me.
Okay. All right.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And then when I get to the hotel, we'll stop and have a little confab. Usually, I haven't checked the weather forecast very thoroughly just yet, but usually what happens when you get these storms real early in the morning like this, you get all concerned about it, start wondering what's going to happen. 9 times out of 10, if you say, let's just not go, we will be looking at blue skies and sunshine by 10:30, 11 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the period of time we have to work with here. We might delay things a little bit or we'll see how it goes. I'm never a big fan of going fishing, especially on the heels of a thunderstorm. But I will say that if the weather is unsettled and there's some threatening clouds and so on out in the atmosphere, if you're going to fish, now I'm talking about somebody that really wants to go. I got this planned out. I don't want to not go. I drove a long way. I spent some money to get here and so on and so forth. If you're going to do it anyway, you're better off to do it while the weather is still unsettled. It seems like the fish don't really have an adverse reaction to stormy weather until after the storm has passed and the weather gets nice again, then all of a sudden they sort of clamp down and take a little nap. So if you do want to get in on the better part of the fishing, you're better off to do it while these things are still rolling around in the sky. That is only advice for hardcore people who are going to fish no matter what. Okay? Jeff Sundin didn't say go out and fish right. If there's a thunderstorm.
Right.
Okay. All right.
So my dad always convinced me that it was better fishing in the rain, but he was a hardcore fisherman, so, you know, we were out there at all times. So let's start off here. Congratulations. You passed your Minnesota boater certification.
Woohoo! I got a 96%.
Oh, nice.
That wasn't too bad. To be honest with you, I really didn't have to do that. In fact, I would be grandfathered in. They're phasing it in. If you're under 21, it was required that you get this boater certification before July 1st of this year. So for the past almost 2 weeks now, folks have already been subject to the law. But I was thinking about this. I had a little bit of free time anyway, and I knew that there was going to be an update. I would have to write some kind of a story about it. And I thought, you know, instead of just speculating on what it is and what it isn't, why don't I just sign up, take the course, pass my own test, and then I'll have some ideas about what's included in it and so on and so forth. So I spent a week ago Saturday, I suppose maybe 5 hours total. I signed up to take a course from a website called ilearntoboat.com. That's one of the options. There's a lot of different ways that you can take it. You can just get the study material and go through it and try to remember all of the stuff. But I kind of like the way I did it. You follow along a little story about some young people that get on a boat and they have kind of an adventure. As the story unfolds, you periodically stop and have like a little 5-question quiz update, and you have to get 80% on that quiz before they'll let you keep going. And there was a couple of times, me not being hip to a lot of video games and things like that, there was a couple of times where I stumbled, not because I didn't know what the answer to the question was, but they wanted you to kind of do things with the mouse and move things around. And it took me a second or two, so I timed out on a couple of them before I figured out what I had to do. And they do. They don't send you back to the beginning, but they send you back to that section. So you'll get a little message saying, oops, looks like you got some more studying to do. And then they send you back until you can pass that quiz and move on to the next level. At the end of it all, there's a 60-question test that you have to pass in order to get your certification. And that, I would say, that 60-question test was useful, especially for folks that don't know anything about the marker buoys and rules of the road and who has the right of way and so on and so forth, how to steer a jet ski, so on. There was a lot of useful things in there. It was about 60 questions too short, in my opinion. If you're going to go to the trouble of requiring a boater certification course, this one was very lacking when it came to the subject of boater ethics. Like, you know, who should do this under this circumstance, or who has to right away under that circumstance? I thought they could have done a lot more when it came to that. It's really oriented more towards safety, what precautions you should take, what you should know about your boat. The fundamentals were covered pretty well. And I would say everybody probably should have this first section, the 60 questions that I took. I would say probably everybody should have that course already by the time they're about 12, maybe 12 or 13, 14, right in that time frame when parents begin to let the the kids, you know, take control of the boat once in a while. I can remember it was someplace right around in there, 12-ish or so. Now, the boats were a lot smaller back when I was a kid, but, you know, I was allowed to putt around, you know, stay in front of the resort, don't go any farther than where we can, you know, shout at you and make you come back when we think you've been out there too long or whatever. And so I think it would have been good to have it at that time. I would encourage folks, even if you're not required, you probably should take it. And judging by some of the behavior that I've seen on the lake in the past, let's just say since the 4th of July, on a popular Grand Rapids lake that has a nice fireworks display, I would say that there's a whole bunch of people that could really use the rules of the road portion of this test, like right away. Do it today.
Okay. I am going to do it. I'm out on my boat. I'm going to see how I do. And then I think we have an opportunity here to collaborate the KEXE Jeff Sundin Ethics Certification of Fishing. We'll work on that later. How's that?
Okay.
Let's move on. Let's move on to the water, lake water. It's pretty warm. That means it's a good time for fishing with families and kids, right?
This is getting in to be the mixed bag action time. But it's almost to the point now where the water temperatures are like 75, 76, 77. I saw one reading here just lately. And it's getting to the point where the small fish are becoming so active that it makes it difficult to single out the preferred species. So if you want to take the kids out and keep them entertained, it's going to be really, really easy to do. But if you want to take Uncle Bud, the hardcore walleye fisherman, and you want to just spend a day trying to catch walleyes only, now you're going to struggle. The small fish, the mix that's going on, there's some crappies, sunfish, rock bass, small largemouth bass. On one lake, we found some smallmouths. Not a ton of northern pike right now, but they're still out there on certain lakes. I'm sure they're going to show up in the mix. But all of this activity going on, let's just say you've got a walleye laying along the edge of a cabbage patch on a shoreline break line, and that walleye wants to kind of come up and take a look and make sure it's the right bait. They feed more like how a cat would feed compared to how a dog would. The dog is just going to jump in and start eating, and the cat's going to think about it for a second. So that walleye, that cat-like behavior of the walleye, they're going to lay back. They're going to examine your bait. Well, while they're doing that their process, some small sunfish or a little rock bass or whatever is going to come and grab your bait first. So it can get to be, depending on your tolerance for that sort of thing, it could be a problem, or it could be like the best that ever happened to you if you're trying to entertain your kids. So just something to keep in the back of your mind. I had an experience last week with one particular person who became annoyed with catching the bass, and all of the fish just added up. We were busy all the time and we were going through a lot of bait, and to be fair to him, it is kind of a problem, you know, when you're putting on a new night crawler or a new leech every 40 seconds because something just stole the one that you had on there. But that's the way the game is played right now, especially if you're going to fish in the middle of the day.
All right. Well, let's go back to a topic we have touched on before about forward-facing sonar and the ethics of it.
This is another question that came up on a popular Grand Rapids area lake that has a very popular walleye fishing contest in about late June every year. And so here's the question in a nutshell. I'm on the lake and I have the forward facing sonar and I can see a school of fish 100 feet away. And I'm really a good angler, so I stop my boat 100 feet away and I'm targeting that school of fish. Somebody else comes along maybe they don't have any kind of sonar at all, and maybe they've got a little bit, and they become aware that there's fish in that same spot. So what is the ethical? I've been trying to find out if there's a rule for this, like ice fishing. There is a rule. You can only be so close to another ice fishing shelter if somebody's got either a spear house or a portable shelter or whatever. You're not allowed to just go right up alongside and, you know, like park where you're almost on the same spot with somebody else. Now, I can't find that there is that hard and fast rule for boats. It's more of a thing that, you know, people kind of work it out amongst themselves on the lake. Let's just take Winnie, for example, and fast backward until you're into the mid-80s or something like that, when everybody was sort of, it was a pretty level playing field. If you had electronics, they were pretty basic, but you would know that there was fish on a certain brake line or whatever, and people would all get into sort of a exchange. You'd go to the beginning of the line and drift down the shoreline. Then you come to the end of the stretch and people would go back and start over. So it was kind of a lot of boats close by each other, but it was workable because everybody was doing the same thing. So you fast forward now, here we are in the 21st century with high-tech electronics. One person can stake out territory and hit the spot lock on his boat and just sit right there. And the other person has got to figure out whether or not they can fish that spot. Well, if you go to a popular enough lake, this happened to me just a few weeks ago on Bowstring. There was literally every spot, there was somebody spot locked that was marking a school of fish. And I'm the type of person, I'm not going to go there because I just don't even want to get anywhere close to another boat. So I just skipped the spots altogether. But what I figured out, if I'm going to do that kind of fishing, if I'm going to stay away from everybody, I might have to just leave the lake and go someplace else because you've got so many people that are all using the technology and they've all got a piece of territory staked out. Now, if I'm staying at a resort on that lake and I don't have any choice, I have to fish there, how close can I come? If I see somebody with this, the question is, you know, if you're a owner of this technology and somebody comes up alongside of you and they have no choice but to fish the same spot you're fishing on, how close are you going to allow them to come before it's going to upset you and vice versa? You know, somebody else has been out there and they found that spot. And I just had a reader comment, put it up on the report yesterday or the day before, somebody that fishes a lot, and it's become common for him to go out, find a fish. He catches one. Somebody sees him catch the fish, and they move over and kind of get into his territory. So the reverse is true, too. The person without the technology can locate a school of fish, and then somebody who understands what's happening can come over and kind of take over the territory. So we're going to spend some time talking about this. The technology committee, the Walleye Advisory Group Fishing Technology, has a meeting coming up on the 15th of June, and I'm going to throw this out for folks that are on that committee because this is probably one of the bigger issues that we're going to face, is how do people all utilize the same public resource and do it in a way that's kind of fair and level playing field for everybody, no matter whether they get bullied into buying the technology or not.
All right. Well, let's kind of stick with that in terms of the DNR. They are looking for comments. It's a comment period for walleye limit reduction rules. And also let's talk a little bit before we go about walleyes right now.
Yeah, we've been waiting for this for a long time during the last couple of weeks while we weren't on the air together. The DNR finally did make the formal announcement. The proposed rule is that the statewide possession limit on walleyes will drop from 6 fish down to 4 fish. and they've opened up an official public commentary period. This is very easy to find on my website. I've put it back up a couple of times just to make sure that everybody can make a comment on it. Whether or not you agree with me or disagree with me is really unimportant. What is important is that everybody clicks on that link and takes the DNR survey and adds their 2 cents worth into it, if for no other reason than to just let the DNR know that there's lots of people watching, and the better the response, the more it sort of elevates the issue in everybody's mind. And I think it's helpful to let folks know that you have their, what's going to impact the rest of your fishing life, you have their actions on your mind. That's, I guess, the best way to say it. So I've taken the survey myself already, and I've suggested to family and friends that they all do the same thing. And I would really encourage folks to just jump on quick, take a look. The link takes you right straight to the survey, so you can bypass a lot of the other rhetoric that's out there and just go do it. And it takes about 10 minutes and you'll be done and up to speed. So got that. That's one thing to think about. And then if you are, no matter where you are on the limit of walleyes, if you're in kind of the business of trying to figure out how to catch some right now, and you don't want to put up with all of the small panfish and bass and so on and so forth, I think there's two ways this time of year, midsummer, probably the two best ways to beat the system. One, it would be to either fish really early in the morning or really late in the evening. You could probably, maybe a week ago or so, I noticed about 6 o'clock, 5:30, 6 o'clock, I had 2 trips one day and I was out a little later than usual. And around 6-ish, we started to notice that the walleye activity had kind of picked up. The pecking order eventually changes. Even all of the small fish, they can't really feed 100% of the time. They have to take a break at some point. And so when that pecking order changes around, it favors some of the larger predators. The other thing, if you don't want to be fishing during the crepuscular periods, and you'd rather just go someplace where you can fish during the day, an old strategy of mine used to be to take some time off midsummer. We would go to Rainy Lake. It seems like when you move that extra 100 miles further north, this could be Rainy Lake, it could be Lake of the Woods, any of the border waters, you sort of buy back a couple of weeks of the summer progress. And it's like going back into June a little bit. So the fish are a little more active, a little easier to find. They're just moving on to mid-lake structure and things like that. So a trip further north, that's not a bad way to go this time of year either. And I see according to the reports up at Lake of the Woods, the action is ramping up there. So that's an option. And like I say, my favorite personally is Rainy Lake, but there's lots of other choices out there, and wouldn't be a bad time to plan a trip like that.
You can find the information Jeff's been talking about at his website. It's jeffsundin.com. Have a great week. We'll check in next Thursday.
Thank you. We'll see ya.
See ya. This is the Thursday Morning Show. It's People Powered KAXE, and we appreciate you listening, your support, your help right now as public media is on the line. We'll be telling you more about it throughout the morning. You can check our website as well for more information at kaxe.org. One good way to find out great information and connections to how you can contact your senators is protectmypublicmedia.org. Find the connections there. To support KAXE, where you get fact-checked news and experts like Jeff Sundin, where his passion shines through, but he gives us information about regulations and keeps us going here in northern Minnesota. We need you to help us out and use your voice. Go to protectmypublicmedia.org, and thank you. Weather around the region, we are seeing rain and thunderstorms. Love to hear from you. A little weather report where you might be. Text us 218-326-1234. We're seeing 61 degrees in Grand Rapids with thunder, Brainerd 69 in thunder, rain in Hibbing 57, Bemidji thunder in the vicinity 66 degrees, And we are looking at a mostly cloudy kind of day with mostly cloudy to partly sunny day, highs 80 to 86, increasing clouds overnight with temperatures in the low to mid 60s. Coming up on National Native News, we're learning about the Eklunta tribe. They have operated a new casino outside of Anchorage, Alaska, under the shadow of two separate lawsuits.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Eklutna tribe has operated its new casino outside Anchorage, Alaska, under the shadow of two separate lawsuits. As KMBA's Rhonda McBride reports, a federal judge has dismissed one.
Ever since a group of property owners tried to block the casino with a lawsuit, tribal advocates have kept a close eye on this case because their attorney, Don Mitchell, challenged the Native Village of Eklutna's status as a federally recognized tribe.
Congress has never allowed a middle-ranking employee of the Interior Department to just wave a magic wand and create 200 Indian tribes, either in Alaska or any other place.
Mitchell is referring to Ada Deer, who was Assistant Interior Secretary in the Bill Clinton administration. In 1993, she included Eklutna in a list of Alaska tribes on the Federal Register to eliminate any doubt that they have the same status as other tribes in the United States. Numerous court cases have tried and failed to invalidate Deer's decision. Last month, U.S. District Judge James Robart stood by those cases and ruled that the Eklutna lawsuit should be dismissed in equity and good conscience. Tribal legal experts like Michelle Demert applauded the ruling, but says cases like this one consume time, energy, and precious dollars.
Time and time again, the law is clear in these areas that continue to be challenged. If the argument was that the Eklutna tribe is not a tribe, you know, there's legal precedent, there's federal law that says they are.
In a statement, Aaron Leggett, the president of the Native Village of Eklutna, called the ruling a significant step forward because it affirmed an important principle to the tribe that its rights are firmly rooted in the land. The tribe does face another lawsuit, this one brought on by the Alaska Attorney General. It also aims to shut down the casino. I'm Rhonda McBride.
A recent federal law that passed in the Canadian Parliament has drawn criticism and anger from Indigenous leaders. More from Dan Karpinchuk.
First, there was Bill 5 from Ontario, which allowed the provincial cabinet to designate special economic zones, the aim to fast-track resource development such as mining of critical minerals. That bill passed without consultation from First Nations, and they say it oversteps treaty obligations. Now at the federal level, the controversial Bill C-5 has also passed. It's legislation to fast-track major projects across Canada. It gives Ottawa the power to sidestep environmental protections and other laws. Originally, it was aimed at circumventing the Indian Act, but that part was removed. Some Native leaders have warned that it could lead to protests and legal challenges if it does not respect rights and title. And some had called on members of Parliament and other lawmakers to slow down Bill C-5 so that Indigenous leaders could review the law. Senator Paul Prosper, who is Mi'kmaq, is calling the rushed passage of the legislation a betrayal.
We do not want success and progress to come on the backs of Indigenous peoples. We want to be at the table, making decisions alongside Canadian politicians, because these decisions affect us. They affect our lands and resources.
Prosper said Canada is becoming a country of extremes and the ability for moderate social discourse is gone. The Canadian Chamber of Commerce praised the quick passage of the bill, saying it has the potential to unleash the Canadian economy, but also urged the government to ensure that there is full compliance with rights of Indigenous communities and environmental standards. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding in part by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the Ford Foundation. Thanks so much for tuning in on this Thursday morning. Rainy and thunderstorms across much of northern Minnesota right now, unless you tell us otherwise. We're seeing that on our weather radar. Looks like possibly Park Rapids is not seeing anything yet, but some clouds moving in. We are looking at a day that where we do have a chance of showers and thunderstorms, and that includes into tonight. Partly sunny with highs 80 to 86, and tonight temperatures in the low to mid 60s. Coming up, we'll have the set list with Malachi Coons. We'd like to thank Dragonfly Coffee for their support in Central Square Mall in Grand Rapids, featuring a scratch bakery and offering espresso, bubble tea, and more, empowering inclusion and community through employment. Special orders are available and more at drinkdragonfly.com.
This is the set list on KAXE, where we highlight live music around the area for the upcoming week. I'm Malachi Coons. We are looking at shows Thursday, July 10th through Saturday, July 12th in Duluth, Grand Rapids, Fauston, Crosby, and Coleraine. Starting things off, the first of three Thursday shows is the Cactus Blossoms and Boxcar from 5 to 8 p.m. in Duluth, part of the Downtown Days celebration. The retro country and rock and roll group, led by brothers Jack Torrey and Paige Burkham, are fan favorites, with a live band that includes in-demand players Jake and Jeremy Hansen. Opening for them are Boxcar, a Duluth alts and classic country band. That's 5 p.m. in downtown Duluth. In Grand Rapids, Diddy Wish is performing with her new band at Rapids Brewing at 6 p.m. Since the release of her debut EP, Songs About Home, the singer-songwriter has added keys and drums to her solo sound. Thursday at 6 in Grand Rapids. Then at 7 o'clock, Kaylee are performing in Fauston. The Bemidji-based trio fuse folk, Celtic, bluegrass, and old time. The show is at the East Folk Heritage Center, Thursday night at 7. On to Friday, Americana singer-songwriter Scott Jasmine is performing in Crosby at 7. It'll be at the Cana Wine Bar. And then on Saturday, Mount Itasca in Coleraine is hosting their Music on the Mountain Festival with eclectic blues duo Brothers Burn Mountain and folk rock group Morning Bird. Gates open at 5 p.m. and music begins at 6. That is Music on the Mountain, this Saturday, 5 o'clock at Mount Itasca. Do you have information on live music you'd like us to know about? Email comments at kaxc.org. The set list is made possible by the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund, and we'll post the latest edition every Wednesday at kaxc.org.
Hey, thanks for listening to your public radio station, which brings you Morning Edition, the most popular radio news program in the United States, where you get voices of people in the news and reports from around the world. We know you have millions of options to get somebody's opinion on the news. Millions of options for a take on the news, but few options where you can get people who dig up facts and go to the scene to look and give you the information to make your decision. And this public radio station is the place for that, where you get NPR News.
This public radio station is KAXE. We are people-powered. We are not governed by algorithms or corporations. We are governed by people, people like you. We need you to join us and keep us people-powered. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234. I'm Heidi Holton, and I thank you for your support. There she is. It's Margot Price. It's off her album from 2023, Strays. It's Bend to the Mountain. I'm Heidi Holton. I caught on Lakeland Public Television last weekend Austin City Limits that featured Margot Price performing this song. And I loved her already, but if you haven't seen it yet, you should see her performance there. We're getting so excited for the Grand Rapids River Fest that is coming up on September 6th, and we need you to join us. Ask your friends and neighbors. Help us make this a big success for a small station like KEXE to bring great talent like this to celebrate the town and KEXE and this community. GrandRapidsRiverFest.com, that is the place to buy your tickets, the only place where you can get those. And we are so excited because it is .org. Sorry, GrandRapidsRiverFest.org. You'll hear me typing as I go right to this website. We've also got Courtney Barnett, Margot Price, Jeremy Albino, and Alan Sparhawk. We're so excited for this. We hope to see you there. Go to GrandRapidsRiverFest.org. Coming up, we've got local news with the Up North Report. We do have showers and thunderstorms coming down across the region right now, partly sunny through the day with highs 80 to 86, southeast winds 10 to 15, increasing clouds tonight with temperatures in the low to mid 60s and a chance for showers and thunderstorms. Showers are likely tomorrow with possible thunderstorms, highs 80 to 83 degrees. We receive support from Grand Rapids State Bank, committed to serving the Grand Rapids area for over 110 years. More at grsb.bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. And thanks also to Paul Bunyan Communications. They're powered by the